11. Endings, beginnings. In the last few hours, neither Paul nor I brought up the possibility that nothing would happen and he would be back in a couple of weeks, as if talking about it might have jinxed us. Red did drop a hint, though, obliquely. I was waiting by the airlock that led to the shuttle, and he came walking up with a bundle tucked under a large and small arm. It was the gauzy tent he wore when he ventured out onto the surface of Mars.
"Just for safety's sake," he said. "You never know."
It would protect him for a couple of hours EVA or moonwalk, or keep him alive for a while if the shuttle's life support shut down. Paul came out of the airlock looking like a Space Force recruiting cube shot, gleaming white spacesuit. He had shaved his head and had feely contacts pasted on his skull. I was composed. Oz had given me a couple of slap-on tranquilizers, but I wanted to hold off on them until after the launch. Paul put his helmet down and swept me up in an armored hug. That was not exactly the way I wanted to remember his body, hidden behind bulletproof plastic, but I could imagine what was underneath. "You remember the day we met?" I said, throwing a pebble at the iguana. He smiled. "Yeah." "Think you can manage to hit the moon?"
"It's a lot bigger."
He gave me a last hard kiss and stepped back. No goodbye or see you. Just a long, intent look. And then he picked up his helmet and went through the airlock. When it closed, I put one of the patches on my wrist. When the reverberating bang meant they had launched, I slapped on the second. We had saved one bottle of the imported Bordeaux for some future celebration. I held it for a long time, remembering. But then, I put it back and went down to the mess and made a glass of grape juice laced with ethanol. I carried the drink up to Earth A, where almost everyone else was gathered. I almost wished they had let Dargo out to watch the consequences of her judgment, but I would probably have said something or done something I'd later regret. If there was a later. The Hubble showed the little ship drifting along in the bright sunlight, occasional background stars going by unhurriedly. Paul talked with technical people here and on Earth, and Red kept up a constant monologue. Fly-in Amber said it was all apparently in Red's own language, a message for his successor. Or perhaps for the others, eventually. The alcohol and drugs made me very sleepy. I ate a hamburger because I knew I had to have something, and then went up to my quarters and slept dreamlessly for 20 hours. I awoke to my own timer, the phone, and the computer screen all buzzing and pinging. I turned them all off, knowing what they meant, and went to the head. Splashed water on my face and jerked a comb through my hair, and went up to Earth A. They weren't using the Hubble, because the moon is too bright for it to focus on. Oz said it was a telescope in Hawaii. It showed the Mars lander as a small cylindrical shape, moving toward the limb of the moon. I knew it would be decelerating, but you couldn't tell by looking. Paul's voice was suddenly loud.
"We'll be making planet fall. Moonfall, I guess, in about 22 minutes. 21. Lose radio contact in less than a minute."
The image of the ship and the moon's limb were almost touching.
I don't have any last words. Crash Collins signing off. Hope this works. Dargo, I'll see you in hell. Darling, good.
Well, at least Dargo would get all of her message, even if mine required a little imagination. Josie came up and held me from one side, and Meryl from the other. Meryl sobbed.
"People won't know he already had the nickname."
The view shifted to Earth's side, the nearly full moon high over a placid ocean. Maybe it was from the Hawaiian mountaintop where the observatory was. After what seemed a lot longer than 20 minutes, A voice from the cube said,
1 minute to touchdown.
We held our breath for a minute, then another minute. We didn't know what to expect. After 20 minutes or so, people started drifting away, back to their quarters or down to the mess, or just to wander. For some reason, I kept staring at the moon, maybe wishing I was there in Hawaii, maybe not thinking anything much. Whatever, I was one of the few people actually watching when it happened. At first, there was just a faint glow surrounding the moon, as if a wispy cloud had moved in front of it. Then, it was suddenly dramatic. People who have seen total solar eclipses say it was like that, but more so. A brilliant nimbus of pearly light spread across half the sky, the full moon suddenly a black circle in the middle, dark by contrast. A crackle of static and a human voice.
Holy shit! That was close!
Paul!
It was Red who had suggested the plan, which was probably not something a sane space pilot would have come up with. After touchdown, when he was careening along on skis, trying not to live up to his nickname, he should look for an area that was locally uphill. Try to stop with the lander pointed at least slightly skyward. Then, Red would get off, stand clear, and Paul could hit full throttle, get over the horizon, and try to make orbit. When he disappeared from sight, Red would measure off 10 minutes, and then open his suit and die. That would give Paul time to make orbit, but not so much time that he would go completely around and be over Red when he died. The supposition that Red's death would trigger the explosion turned out to be a good guess. It was a combination of luck and skill. He could steer to a certain extent with the skis, and so when he had almost slowed to nothing, he aimed for the slope of some small nameless crater. When he slid to a stop, he was pointing about 15 degrees uphill, with nothing in the way. Red was already wearing his gauzy suit. He cycled through the airlock and picked his way down the crater side. As soon as he said he was clear, Paul goosed it. Once over the horizon, he tweaked the attitude so he got into a low lunar orbit and waited. When it blew, he was almost blinded by sparkles in his eyes, gamma rays rushing through, and he had a sudden feverish heat all over his body. Behind him, he could see the glow of vaporized lunar material being blasted into the sky. That little crater that saved him really earned the right to a name. But it had boiled completely away, along with everything else for hundreds of kilometers, and in its place was a perfectly circular hole bigger than Tsiolkovsky, previously the largest crater. I thought they should name it Crash. So every January 1st, we present a petition for lifting the quarantine, and every year our case is not strong enough. But now there's a space elevator on Mars, so there's a lot of pretty cheap travel back and forth within the quarantine. After 5 years on New Mars, we went back. And it was good to have a planet beneath your feet, and over your head as well. Oz invented a church of holy rational weirdness so that he could marry me with Paul and not offend any of our sensibilities. I was pregnant and thought there were already too many bastards on Mars. My first was a girl, and I named her after her grandmother so I could see her smile. Her middle name is Mayfly, and I hope she lives forever. The second, with the same middle name, was a boy. People who don't know us might wonder why a kid with jet black hair would be named Red.
This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive producer Steve Feldberg. Supervising producer Mike Charzik. Producer Gail Hendricks. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2008 by Joe Haldeman. Audio recording copyright 2008 by Audible, Inc.